Okay, and I'm Ken Smethers. I'm a non-resident fellow here at AEI and a professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. And CBO, as you know, recently released an important new study on healthcare costs. This has very big implications for Medicare, Medicaid, and even healthcare in general. And we're very delighted to have Peter Horzag, director at the CBO, to discuss this important new study. And this is part of an ongoing discussion series that we're having on long-term problems facing the federal budget. Peter, as many of you know, is now a director of CBO. He was previously had a chair position at Brookings and served as deputy economics director. And prior to that, he was a special assistant to President Clinton. He's written many books and articles, very prolific, extremely hardworking guy, so much so that his replacement at Brookings pointed out he's only a third replacement at Brookings because no one could quite replace Peter's work ethic. Tom Miller will discuss Peter's comments, and he's a resident fellow at AEI focusing on healthcare, previously served as a senior healthcare economist and joint economic committee, and Peter will talk for our work pretty flexible half hour or so, and Tom will talk about for 15 minutes or so. We're going to leave at least, you know, hopefully a half hour open for our Q&A, so definitely get your questions ready, and we'll have a mic and so forth. All right, go.
Well, thank you very much, Kent, and I appreciate being back here at the American Enterprise Institute, especially because AEI has been among the leaders in highlighting the nation's long-term fiscal problems and what can be done about them. We at CBO are going to be coming out with some new long-term budget projections in December, and it will be no surprise to anyone in this room that a key variable affecting that long-term fiscal outlook is the rate at which healthcare costs grow. And because we will, embodied in those new projections, will be a new methodology for projecting healthcare costs, we came out with a separate report that describes our methodology for future projections of health spending. And that's what I'd like to spend some time speaking to you about this morning, and also describe some options that might help bend the cost curve over the long term. So, the first unremarkable fact is that healthcare spending has been rising rapidly as a share of the economy. As this chart shows, it was under 5% of GDP in 1960. It's now more than 15% of GDP, so it's tripled over the past 4.5 decades or so. And the key question is how to project that forward. I think it's a fairly safe bet to project some continued increase in healthcare spending as a share of the economy. The question is how rapidly and how much. One starting point for projecting the future is often just to look at historical growth rates in the past. And the way that many of these projections are done is to examine the cost per beneficiary. So if costs per beneficiary are going up 5% per year, say, relative to income per capita, that is how much income per person is rising. And that differential is called the excess cost growth rate. Excess does not necessarily mean excessive. It just means that it's growing faster than income is. And this bottom row in this table shows you the average excess cost growth rate for Medicare, for Medicaid, and for the rest of the health system since 1975. We started in 1975 to allow time for Medicare and Medicaid, which were created in the mid-1960s, to have some ramp up before we started the measurement. As the chart shows you, all three parts of the healthcare system, or those three parts of the healthcare system, Medicare, Medicaid, and the rest of it, were all growing on average between 2 and 2.5% per year in terms of this excess cost growth factor. And so a couple things are worth noting about that. First, the growth rates are fairly similar, and that's not too surprising. Medicare and Medicaid patients are generally being seen in the same facilities as other patients. Doctors are treating both kinds of patients. Practice norms are prevalent throughout the public and private systems. Basically, the systems are integrated to some degree, and therefore it's not surprising that growth rates in Medicare, Medicaid, and in the rest of the health system are tracking each other fairly closely over long periods of time. The second thing to note is that during the 1990s, growth rates were lower. And I show you that right above there. Instead of averaging a little over 2% for the health sector as a whole, the growth rate during the from 1990 to 2005 was about 1.5 percentage points. Now, some people say in projecting the future, you should use the experience from the 1990s forward. We chose not to do that because, in our view, there were several things that were happening during the 1990s that likely had a one-time effect on the cost level and may not have affected the underlying growth rate trend, such as the expansion of managed care in the private part of the health system, which, according to our read of the evidence, has an effect mostly on the level of costs and not on the underlying growth rate. If you have a reduction in the level of costs over some short period of time, that will manifest itself as a lower growth rate for some period of time, but you don't want to then project that out over longer periods of time if it is a one-time shift. And for that reason, and also because the year-to-year fluctuations in these growth rates are fairly substantial, underscoring the benefits of a longer averaging period, we decided to take the average from 1975 forward as our jumping-off point for future projections. One other thing quickly to note about the year-to-year fluctuations is that although on average, over long periods of time, the growth rates tend to track each other fairly closely, you can see that in any given year, some years Medicare is growing faster, and some years Medicaid's growing faster, and some years the rest of the health system is growing faster. So these things bounce around from year to year, even though on average, over long periods of time, they have tended to track each other fairly closely in the past. All right, so we're going to take the average growth rate from 1975 forward and project it forward into the future. And one simple projection methodology is just to assume that that past growth rate will occur in the future also, and project that out over time. This chart shows you the results of that simple projection. It has a couple unfortunate features, the first of which is that by the end of the projection period, healthcare is 100% of the economy, which is not going to happen. The second is that conceptually, we are supposed to, in these projections, keep federal policy fixed. But conceptually, we are not supposed to keep private behavior fixed or state government policy fixed. And one would think that as healthcare costs become 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70% of GDP of the economy, there will be significant counter pressure to slow the growth rate in healthcare costs, even in the absence of a federal policy change. So one would expect some slowing of the growth rate in the future through potentially quite painful steps, like slower diffusion of technology, through tighter utilization management techniques, through increased cost sharing that is imposed on employees and other beneficiaries, and various changes in practice norms among doctors, various changes that will not automatically occur, but that the private sector and state governments could engineer to some degree as healthcare costs continue to rise rapidly. Our projections embody that thought, that even in the absence of federal policy changes, there will be some slowing in the rest of the health system to prevent consumption of all other things like cars and refrigerators and houses from declining in real terms. There are various different metrics that one could apply to try to calibrate how much slowing of growth rates will occur in the rest of the health system, and that's one, and we could talk about it. That slowing, or the steps that are taken to slow the growth rate in the future in the private sector and at the state government level, will have some effects on federal policy, on the federal programs, Medicare, and especially Medicaid, which is a mixed federal and state government program. But even for Medicare, changes in practice norms among doctors and changes in technology adoption may have some effect without a change in current law. Without changing federal policy, there will be some spillover effects. And so the results of the methodology that we have for projecting these components of the healthcare system give you this picture. Instead of healthcare reaching 100% of GDP by the end of the period, it reaches about 50% of GDP by the end of the period. Medicare and Medicaid, which is currently 4% of, which currently account for 4% of the economy, triple by 2050 to 12% of the economy, and then reach nearly 20% of the economy by the end of the projection window in 2082. So it's still not a pretty picture, but it, in our mind, is more realistic than assuming that healthcare costs continue to grow at the same rate automatically in the future as they did in the past. One other feature of this picture is that the federal programs, Medicare and Medicaid, will in the future, under this scenario, grow faster than the rest of the health system because the spillover effects are not full. I don't believe in reality that will actually occur, but it will take changes in federal law and federal policy to avoid it from occurring. In other words, this is not, what we're showing you is not a prediction of the future because it fixes federal policy. Federal policy will change. Instead, it's a scenario that is intended to illustrate the consequences of an unchanged federal policy. And those consequences are not pretty. They involve very steeply rising healthcare costs over time. There have been other official projections that have been done of healthcare costs, Medicare, for example. And this chart shows you the intermediate projections from the Medicare trustees. And as you can see, over the next couple decades, our projections track those of the Medicare trustees fairly closely. And thereafter, they diverge to some degree. The reason they diverge thereafter is that the Medicare trustees constrain that excess cost growth rate between the 25th year and the 75th year to average 1% per year. And again, remember that historically it's been over 2. We don't constrain the system that way, and we wind up being somewhat higher than the trustees, about 50% higher by the end of the projection window. But I would note that both sets of projections are telling the same basic story, and in fact, a very similar story for the next couple decades. And that story is that under current law, we face very steeply rising costs for these for the programs like Medicare. And this is the central long-term fiscal challenge facing the United States. That increase, whether you take our numbers or the trustees' numbers, is far larger than the projected increases in other programs, including, for example, Social Security. And that brings me to my next point, which is that to some very substantial degree, the nature of the nation's long-term fiscal problem has been fundamentally misdiagnosed, and I am guilty of this along with many other think tank and academic colleagues and many in the media. The long-term fiscal picture or problem is often presented as fundamentally a demographic one, in which the tidal wave of the coming retirement of the baby boomers overwhelms the federal budget, and that is the problem. When you dig underneath the projections a little bit more, however, it emerges that while aging is a problem, it is not by any means even close to the largest driver of the nation's fiscal imbalance. So let's just take Medicare and Medicaid, for example, in these projections. The dark blue area in that chart shows you the pure effect of aging on our projected costs for Medicare and Medicaid. That's basically tracking the number of beneficiaries. So as the population gets older, we're going to have more Medicare and Medicaid beneficiaries. That's going to drive up costs. And they're also going to be older beneficiaries, and that will drive up costs to some degree also. The light blue area tracks the cost per beneficiary. And I think you can immediately see from this chart that the vast bulk, in fact, by the end of the projection window, about 90% of the projected increase in spending is caused by increasing cost per beneficiary rather than aging and more beneficiaries. And this chart, if we added Social Security to it, it would change just a little bit, but the basic message would still hold, that while demographics do affect the federal budget, by far the larger problem in terms of our fiscal outlook is this excess cost growth or the cost per beneficiary that growth that exceeds income per capita. Relative to that picture, we have woefully underinvested in analyses and options and books that tackle that problem as opposed to the demographic one. In fact, I think if you looked at the ratio of books dedicated to the demographic problem as opposed to the excess cost growth problem, it would basically be inversely proportional to the underlying dynamic here. We'd have something like 9 times as many books on the demographics than on healthcare excess cost growth. And by any sensible investment strategy, that should be reversed. One of my top priorities at CBO is to be significantly expanding our health resources and our health staff and the work that we're doing on healthcare, in part to rectify that imbalance. So what are some thoughts on why we seem to be experiencing rapid excess cost growth and what potential there might be to reduce it in the future? I would note that embedded in this central long-term fiscal challenge facing the United States appears to be a remarkable opportunity. And that remarkable opportunity is to reduce or eliminate costs in the system without harming health outcomes. So in other words, it is possible that we might be able to reduce healthcare spending, perhaps quite significantly, without harming health outcomes. I recently formed a panel of health advisors, which includes top health analysts from across the country, and asked them, what share of healthcare spending do you believe could be reduced without harming quality or outcomes? And the answers I got back, there were a couple people who weren't willing to answer the question because they weren't willing to answer it. But most were, and the answers I got back ranged from 5 to 50%, with the most common response being 30%. We're currently spending 16% of GDP on healthcare. 30% of 16% of GDP is roughly 5% of the economy. Eliminating 5% of GDP in healthcare costs at no apparent adverse consequences for health outcomes is an opportunity that is so beyond imagination and so larger than any other fiscal magnitude that we tend to talk about that it's remarkable that we're doing so little to try to capture it. So what's the evidence for that opportunity and what might help us, and I'm not saying it'll be easy to capture, by the way, but what's the evidence for it and what are sort of the hints of what might help us capture it? I think by far the most compelling evidence in favor of that proposition is the very dramatic variation in Medicare costs per beneficiary, which are illustrated in this graph, with the darker areas of the country involving much higher costs per beneficiary than the lighter areas of the country. For reasons that a team up at Dartmouth, which has spent basically its entire professional career trying to explain, cannot. When they try to throw in explanatory variables like the underlying riskiness of the patients and the cost of building a hospital and local wages and what have you, they can reduce the variation by perhaps a third, leaving very substantial variation across different parts of the United States. And the kicker is that the higher cost areas do not seem to generate better health outcomes than the lower cost areas. And in fact, if anything, the simple correlation goes the wrong way. I'd also note, by the way, that we are often compared, the U.S. is often compared to other countries in terms of how much we spend on health and then our health outcomes, and people say we don't look so good by those comparisons. But there are very significant parts of the country, those light areas, where costs are either the same or lower than in other significant industrialized economies, and outcomes are just as good, if not better. In other words, there are parts of the U.S. health system that are delivering more cost-effective care than the alternative systems that are often held up as being superior to the U.S. health system. And I think that just underscores the importance of getting under the hood of why this variation is occurring and what's driving it. So let's just spend a couple moments on that. This graph might be a little bit difficult to understand, but basically, if the dot is near that vertical line, that means that the variation across different parts of the United States is not very substantial. And if it's far from the line, then the variation is larger. And here's the point. Things that we know work, like giving someone who has a heart attack and shows up at a hospital an aspirin, we know that is an effective intervention. That doesn't vary very much across, that doesn't vary significantly across parts of the United States. So things that we know work, there's not that much variation in across different parts of the U.S. Things where there's a lot more ambiguity about whether the care is appropriate or not, there's much more substantial variation. So for example, look at imaging and diagnostic tests. Take imaging. My favorite example is MRIs. The MRI was a very substantial advance that allowed the diagnosis of many, many conditions that would have been difficult to diagnose in the past. But it then gets applied in many settings where it has a very low probability of affecting the diagnosis at all, which then drives up costs for no improvement in quality. And you replicate that on over and over again in different settings, and you wind up with the kind of pattern, I believe, that we see in that aggregate graph, which is that in the darker areas of the country, there is care that's being delivered, which is not backed by scientific evidence, and the more intervention, and the variation again occurs where it's less clear what should happen. In the more interventionist parts of the country, there are more procedures, more hospital visits, more specialist visits, and what have you. Again, that is not backed by specific medical evidence suggesting that those kind of interventions are beneficial. And the result is that we drive up costs without improving quality. Now, one other response to the graph is look at those dark areas, and it's not. It has been remarked that the dark areas disproportionately have our top medical centers. And as is fairly well known, the healthcare delivered at our top medical centers is basically the best in the world. So maybe that's what's explaining this variation. And I found that fascinating, so I will put up this chart, which compares three different top medical centers in different parts of the country. The names will be familiar to those of you who are active in the health field. The first line of the chart shows you that ranked on quality, there's not any significant difference in outcomes for these three top medical centers. These results, by the way, are for Medicare beneficiaries in the last 6 months of life, so they are all disproportionately quite sick. The most interesting part of this graph is look at total Medicare spending per beneficiary last 6 months of life. At one of these top medical centers, $50,000. At another, $26,000. Leading to the obvious question of how can the best medical care in the world cost twice as much as the best medical care in the world? And I think the answer involves that at the higher cost medical centers, there's a lot more hospital days and physician visits and imaging and other things being done that's not actually boosting quality. It's not actually improving outcomes in any way, but it is very substantially driving up costs. Costs varying by a factor of two at top medical centers, that's a pretty big deal. And again, I think the reason is disproportionately that the more interventionist approaches are occurring in areas where it's less clear what should happen. And then the second contributory factor to that is that we have a healthcare financing system that accommodates low-value care being delivered. And the reason it accommodates low-value care being delivered is that on the provider side, we have basically a fee-for-service system where the more you do, the more you get paid. And on the consumer side, we have fairly low cost sharing, which means that at the margin, if the MRI costs $1,000 and I'm only paying a little bit of it, I don't really care that much whether you order the MRI for me or not. Let me start with consumers. Despite what you read in the media, it is remarkable that the share of healthcare spending that comes out of pocket has actually plummeted over the past several decades, from about a third in 1975 to about 15% today. And all of the available evidence, whether it's from the RAND experiment or the introduction of Medicare in the 1960s or what have you, suggests that that drives up costs overall. So because we all individually pay less for each procedure, we get more procedures, drives up costs for all of us, and we all collectively then pay more. Now, some people therefore take that insight and say, well, what we need is more cost sharing for consumers. And again, the evidence suggests that that would have some effect. But there is an inherent limit to the traction you get from that kind of approach. And the reason is that another important fact about healthcare spending is it's very concentrated among catastrophic cases. So in Medicare, for example, the top 5% of beneficiaries ranked by cost account for 43% of total costs. The top 25% of beneficiaries account for 85% of costs. Every consumer-directed health plan or HSA-type approach that I've seen provides very generous insurance against catastrophic costs, after all, that is the purpose of insurance, to provide protection against catastrophic costs. That creates an inherent tension between the traction you get through more consumer cost sharing and the desire to provide full or generous insurance against catastrophic costs, which account for such a large share of total costs. In other words, you're operating on a fairly small share of overall costs when you introduce more cost sharing because you're not willing to do that for catastrophic cases. Now, it turns out the evidence suggests when you introduce more cost sharing even for non-catastrophic levels, you somewhat reduce catastrophic costs, but the effect is not huge. So the bottom line is more cost sharing for consumers could help to reduce costs. Again, the evidence suggests that at least with for everyone except low-income sick beneficiaries, the reduction in costs would not harm quality or outcomes. But don't expect miracles because of this inherent limit to the traction that you get given the dominance of catastrophic costs. And that brings me back to provider incentives. And some people say, well, we can only do things on the consumer side, or we can only do things on the provider side. That seems to me an artificial distinction that does not need to occur. There's no reason why you can't be making changes on both sides of the scissors, as it were. But one would expect, given this limit from what we can hope for on the consumer side, that changes in the incentives for providers will be crucially important to capturing this opportunity, and it will not be easy. To a first approximation in healthcare, I think we get what we provide financial incentives for providers to provide. We have strong incentives for high-tech innovation. We get a lot of high-tech innovation. We don't have strong incentives for preventative medicine. We don't get a lot of that. So the question is, how can you steer financial incentives for providers, which are very, very powerful, towards higher value care rather than just more care? And there are various things that are being talked about. A key step along that path, though, will be to be very substantially building out the evidence base on what works and what doesn't. We do very little work in the United States on comparing this intervention versus that intervention. Even for pharmaceuticals, the testing that is done is this drug versus a placebo. It's not this drug versus that drug. It's not this drug versus that drug versus surgery. We need to be doing a lot more of that. And electronic health records and a health information technology backbone could be very beneficial in providing the data that would allow that kind of analysis, which could then be tied to financial incentives for providers. In other words, you would pay more for the stuff that works and pay less for the stuff that doesn't work and try to steer the health sector towards higher value care through that kind of system. I'd be happy to talk more about some of the details of the proposals and other things that are discussed under discussion on that. But with that, I will wrap up and turn it over to Tom. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Peter. That was excellent. So Tom will give 10, 15 minutes, however long you need.
And I'll consume as much time as I yield to myself.
Okay, there we go.
Okay. First off, this is good, high quality work by CBO. It's important that they place a higher priority on health spending. I salute them for that, and all health policy researchers in the future do as well. Keep the economy moving. Now, that'd be a nice thing to say, and you know, there are limits to scoring conventions, but I'm not here to say that. So let me kind of get into some other stuff. But I do acknowledge the quality of the work. First, we'll do a little bit of a rapid fire run through of which one?
Get the right.
Right, okay. This is basically our future federal budget and the economy, basically ATM government. Transfer payments, squeeze out everything else, so that's kind of the quick future in a nutshell. I'm doing these as kind of special graphics despite the TV for C-SPAN because I want to maintain the live crowd as opposed to a pay-per-view. Now here's kind of basically our march. We started in 1965 with entitlements of Medicare and Medicaid seemed like a good idea at the time. We don't know if there's any water down below as we kind of get to the edge. This is kind of a quick summary of our bipartisan search for compromise in healthcare debate. This is a famous magazine cover in the early 1970s in National Lampoon. It was kind of the marketing approach, which basically said, if you don't buy this magazine, we'll kill this dog. That's in essence how everybody kind of goes with their first preference of options in health policy, whether it's SCHIP, currently Medicare reform, tax credits covering the uninsured. The second choice of everyone is to shoot the dog. We're going to be on a round of enthusiasm over universal coverage. Many of you are familiar with the various cycles of that policy debate. It's quite similar to a cycle we're familiar with in this area. Happens about every 17 years. They're known as the cicadas. They come out briefly. They're moderately annoying. They're not really that harmful, but then they burrow into the ground and they're gone for another 17 years. Just suggesting we've been here before, we'll be here again. Now, this is kind of a quick look at CBO's long-term spending outlook. CBO, in the combination of Mr. Magoo, some of you will remember him as the nearsighted cartoon character, not exactly a visionary, but combining that in a Scrooge mode, so also kind of being careful with the pennies. Okay, that's kind of the fast version. The long and short of kind of these spending projections, and admittedly CBO used to be under older management in the past, not new and improved, but the future ain't always what it used to be, according to Yogi Berra. Now, I actually went back into the archives. It's tough to find these things because you like to bury your mistakes, but these are out there. There was a projection in 1994 by CBO. It's tough to kind of forecast trends that change. But the forecast back then in 1994 said we'd have 20% of GDP accounted for by health spending by 2004 if the current system has not changed. We didn't change the system as much in terms of politics, but everything was going on beneath the radar at that time, apparently, in the private sector, managed care, changes in kind of health spending trends. The actual result in 2004, of course, was 15.9% of GDP. It's only a miss by 25%. That's rounding error for government work. But it suggests it's very difficult to capture changes in trends before they happen. It's kind of like predicting recessions. You know you're in them when NBER reports it a year later, but you don't always recognize it. Kind of, there may be some things underneath the surface that are going on that is more than just a projection of kind of current thinking. Pickford, to be fair, also got that wrong, not as much in the year before in a CBO document. They were predicting that it would be 15% of GDP by the year 2000, which was a little bit on the low side back then. This is the point I'm making about kind of, now this is not getting into, I didn't throw the data up there for Medicare, which are not as clean as this. But if you look at kind of the trend lines from the major surveys, this is the Kaiser HRET main one for most employers. I'll show you some others in a second. In terms of, it's like riding a roller coaster. Sometimes it's called the Jaws of Death, I think is what Artie Milstein has called it at Mercer. But you can kind of see we had that big inflationary period and high healthcare cost growth in the early 90s. Dip down, that has obviously managed care effects and some other things going on at that trough in 96. Then people didn't see it was going to climb back up, but it did. That, I think, surprised individuals as well. It was kind of peaking in double digits in the early 2000s. And no one was predicting it was going to come back down again. We're right now down to 6.1%. This is the annual increase in private employer health benefits costs. It's not capturing the totality, but it's a significant trend. The question is, do we just blink this off and say it's a one-time event? We can call everything a one-time event. Or maybe there's a trend going on. Do we know when it's going to stop? It may go back up again. My suggestion is, though, that these are kind of far from kind of linear extrapolations, and there's much going on. If you look at, I just turned myself off. There we go. These are some other other surveys. The underlying one there in the, let's see if we get my colors right. Kaiser is the darker green kind of on the bottom. But you see kind of the Mercer trend line pretty much going up the same. They capture kind of a different mix of employers and tend to, I think, be a little bit on the lower side in terms of premium trends. NHE captures everything, which includes uninsured spending, which tends to increase at a lower rate, and FEHC you see going there as well. So it again suggests kind of that there's, you know, a bit more of a bumpy ride in terms of kind of this development. Now, what are some limiting factors in why healthcare costs don't go through the roof? There's a famous quote with regard to constitutional law by Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes said, the Constitution is not a mutual suicide pact. We may be lemmings, but eventually we stop short of the water. In the same way, there are kind of some built-in stabilizers which prevent us from going on forever when it can't go on. Resource competition with other sectors, as Peter alluded to. It's not quite a food fight, but at a certain point, people have other things to do with their money. They'd like to spend a few dollars on luxury items like food, shelter, clothing, maybe transportation. The imperatives, of course, of alcohol and tobacco. But other people kind of have needs for other resources at the limiting factor. In the same way, medical manpower. You just don't have enough doctors to throw bills down as you kind of get to a high enough share of the economy. I mean, everybody can be their own physician and, I suppose, bill Medicare, but there are limits in terms of kind of the underlying labor force to get enough skilled people to deliver those services. So we, in effect, have kind of some natural limits on how far that sector can grow. We muddle through with the third best. Somehow it's not as bad as it seems. We exhaust every other bad alternative first. Now, what CBO is doing, it's rational in one sense, although it's a little out of their normal scoring conventions. They're kind of assuming a floating baseline. You know, if things get really bad, something's going to happen that'll change it in the rest of the economy, and that'll spill over into the public programs. Last time I saw a floating baseline, people were playing tennis on a cruise ship. What is a baseline if it's saying all other things being equal without change, here's what's going to happen? You have to embed those changes in, either through policy instruments, or if the economy is going to correct it anyway, those higher costs weren't there to begin with, because in effect you're saying it's kind of, that's just the way it works in terms of kind of the natural economic cycles. So it's either a solution, by if things get bad enough, we'll come up with a problem, or it's a problem that solves itself. But it's kind of like assuming your solution rather than actually having it. Now, aging, I want to kind of do a little bit on this, because although I'm sympathetic to the point that aging has been overemphasized in a simplistic manner, on the other side of it, you can be too simplistic in looking at a pure aging effect, as opposed to how aging operates within the economy for healthcare among the elderly. There's a lot of back and forth on this in the literature. It starts off by kind of saying, you know, is there a correlation between per capita healthcare spending and time to death? And this goes out kind of over work started by Peter Zweifel, called the red herring. But what also changes, in addition to kind of that time to death calculation, is the composition of the population changes. More people get closer to death as they age. For a while, you save a lot of money because people are living longer, but they're out there in the future. Eventually, there are going to be some costly deaths coming. So you're in a little bit of a competition. Which is the greater effect? The morbidity costs of the survivors, and there are different opinions whether they're going up or down, or the mortality costs of those who are, you know, on that ticket train to death. And it certainly is very expensive in the 6 months of the year beforehand. So what the early studies tried to calculate, you know, go past age and talk about remaining life expectancy, time to death, but that was done retrospectively. You knew who had died. You really didn't kind of give yourself a projection going forward because you had kind of a sense of part of the data. The cost of dying, mortality, generally seems to, you know, will happen at a later age. But what's going on is, even though the per capita healthcare expenditures are not increasing as much, the aggregate healthcare expenditures, the total bundle, because there are more older people who eventually die, that rises faster than the per capita healthcare expenditures. I'm suggesting it's a much more complex set of factors going in there. Now, there's an updated study in Milbank Quarterly which looked at spending growth over a 7-year period and found that kind of some changes are happening between the old elderly and the young elderly. What is showing up here is the younger elderly are consuming health care at a faster rate. Whether it's their last 2 years of life, those are the decedents in effect, they're kind of going to die soon, or those prior to the last 2 years, the survivors, both of them showing kind of more significant consumption of health care at that younger age. Their lifetime Medicare costs, though we're talking just Medicare covered services here, end up being about the same between the two. Now, the argument, and you can argue it either way, is that early spending when you're below age 70 actually making you healthier, so that it's a good investment and it shows up in terms of kind of reduced costs for that next 20 years before you die. There's a long-standing debate over whether there's a compression of morbidity among the elderly or an expansion of morbidity. Most of the evidence up to now suggests it's more of a compression, but that's looking at it in terms of acute medical care costs. The other part of the costs are what are sometimes called the social care costs. People kind of need to be taken care of in other ways, even though they're not going into the hospital as often as they get older. Nursing home, home care, other softer types of treatment, not as much the physician visits. That can, in many cases, by at least some projections in the latest work, suggest that kind of can overpower what are those savings we may be making on the acute care costs. So it's a much more muddled picture. What I'm suggesting is we need more of a micro-analysis of this slice of the economy than just dealing with kind of the larger aggregates as to whether aging is having a factor or not. It's aging plus what it's acting upon. There are also some cohort effects. There's indications that, and blame the baby boomers once again, they're wealthier and better educated. They want more care, and they seem to get it, at least for the moment. The recent growth in healthcare expenditures by that cohort, age 45 to 64, is growing faster than healthcare spending for the elderly on Medicare above age 65. Less use of hospital care, more use of drugs, but in the future, more use of nursing home, more use of home care. And what this may mean is, if you're doing a CBO score, you're looking kind of what's paid for by the public programs in general. But there's other areas of care for the elderly which are paid for privately in one form or another. Some of it goes into Medicaid. There's a lot of other softer spending. So who pays and for what will be more of a factor in the healthcare economy going into the future. Let's take a look at, this is the school of red herring, which was an update on the Zweifel work, which said, well, if we found people didn't have any long-term care costs, these time-to-death things still hold up, and so aging wasn't a factor in it. But the social care costs are growing much faster than medical treatments due to aging. That's likely to continue in the future. And the curve is flattened in terms of that time-to-death. If you go up beyond kind of a year or two out to 10 years before. Now, spending concentration. It's true. Spending is always concentrated. It has been. But it used to be kind of a fixed item. The Burke-Monheit work indicator was a pretty stable situation for a long period of time. Updated work by a couple of researchers at ARC, I should have my names here, Zuvakis and Cohn in January 2007 suggests, at least in those tables, it's getting a little bit less concentrated. We don't know if this is a big trend. They were doing 96 to 2003. But it suggests that there's a little bit of a downturn you can do with the different cohorts, 1%, 2%, 5%, 10%. And elderly, as well as we call elderly, their main cause factor on that was more use of prescription drugs. Might be having effect in terms of deconcentrating spending, because if people are using more pharmaceutical products, they end up with the less expensive hospital costs and more catastrophic expenses later on. I even got a slide for someone in the audience. Jim Lubitz coming up in just a minute, Jim. There you are. See, the older work by Jim, which was terrific with Riley, was pretty much stable in terms of kind of whether it was the last 6 months of life for Medicare. This is last year of life Medicare costs. It was just kind of doing from 76 to 88. It basically hadn't changed a lot. However, and I think it's preliminary, there is a wrong one. I don't have it. There's some work done by some folks in the actuary's office at CMS. Calfo, Smith, and Zaza, which found that the percentage of Medicare spending... I don't have it. Let me go back. There it is. 1994, this is the last year of life, was 26.5%, but 5 years further, it looks like it's creeping up a little bit. Still concentrated, but it's 27.9%, suggesting, contrary to what I was just saying before about spending getting less concentrated for the whole population, when you look at end of life for Medicare, there's at least a little bit of a tick upward. You're actually spending more on those in the last year of life in Medicare. Now, it was somewhat confounding because they weren't sure what kind of effect in that period of time the increased managed care enrollment might be having a little bit of a bias from prior fee-for-service analysis. But the increases in the per capita cost there were showing up greatest in the youngest age groups. We stop torturing and bothering people when they get over 85, at least in terms of the high-tech interventions. They have the custodial work, but we kind of, if they've gotten that far along, we don't pile on the bills. That's the loop. Now, this is kind of out of pocket. Peter's absolutely right with kind of the out-of-pocket spending and kind of the effects in terms of overall healthcare economy. But we often kind of hear about the United States as this kind of cowboy country, nobody's covered for everything. This is OECD data, 2005, the most recent I could find. The red state material is out-of-pocket spending. It'll be like out-of-pocket spending in the red state, except now it's very low here, as a matter of fact. The United States, you can see there, about 13% in the 2005 numbers by OECD. CMS numbers are about, 11.6%, depending on how to calculate it. But you can see we're kind of pretty low compared to even our European brethren with all their wonderful, single-payer, would-be public payment, universal coverage states. It's because we have much more private health insurance, and it's pretty extensive. You can see that's the blue thing, in terms of kind of we're much higher than almost everyone, except for Mexico. Well, that's not only private health insurance. at the far end. So it suggests that kind of there's a lot less out-of-pocket payment in the U.S. system, even compared to European nations, where it's often thought that they're kind of covering everything, except for, of course, the French and Luxembourg, we won't pick on. Let me get to a couple other things. I agree with kind of the need for better information about works in terms of comparative effectiveness, but it only gets you started. Just knowing what might be the better treatment doesn't say what are the doctors and the hospitals and the medical groups doing in practice. That says, now that you know what you're doing, or we think we know what you're doing, and beyond kind of just the process checkpoints, it's what they do, not just what they know. So you want to kind of get better evaluations of comparative efficiency. And defined properly, it's not just the cheapest or the lowest cost. It's a combination of what are your all-in resource costs for treating a particular diagnosis, an episode of care, and what are some quality factors related to that. So you blend that all together, you get a better value measure, but we're not getting that with just kind of comparative effectiveness alone, because you still got to get it out in the field. You know, the physicians and the hospitals, they're going to differ in what they do. We need that information to kind of get to the effects and get to the downstream incentives. There's also a time lag in the research. You know, first you find out what works, then you're yelling it out the window, trying to get them to do it. Sometimes it's 15, 20 years. It's a longer time lag. So in a sense, you want to kind of know what people are actually, how they're performing, how they're going to be accountable, as much as you want to know what is the best or better treatment compared to something else. Now, there are problems with kind of keeping score on this. Peter's taken some heat for kind of a letter to, I guess, Pete Stark in terms of scoring some modest gains in the first 5 years and the next 10 years for comparative effectiveness. If you look hard enough, you can find trace elements, I suppose, of benefits anywhere. But it's kind of a Delaney Clause approach to kind of find, look, I found kind of something, and then we'll kind of find something in the future. I took a look at kind of some other scoring of a, not the same bill, because it's in the S-CHIP bill. This legislation, it was actually folded into kind of the Wired for Healthcare Quality Act in the Senate earlier this summer. The CBO score didn't mention anything at all about kind of any gains from whatever they call these quality reporting organizations. They would have had access to Medicare data. They would have issued reports on quality and kind of efficiency. No scoring there within 5 years, but apparently we could find it for the S-CHIP bill. So what I'm saying is, you look hard enough, you can find something, but that's really consistently. Sometimes there's emphasis on kind of the problem is fee-for-service. Is it fee-for-service or is it third-party payment as a larger effect? Would people paying more money out of their own pocket want a la carte fee-for-service if it costs them more? Or would they begin to kind of say, well, give me more of a bundled price. What are your outcomes? Give me a little more transparency about this. People show they'll often select the managed care option or the higher deductible option when it's their money on the line. So I'm suggesting the more overpowering effect is the guaranteed payer of these services, which comes through extensive third-party coverage and fuels the investment in technology in the future, than just kind of the organizational form to say a fee-for-service. All right, I'm going to wrap up with kind of a few positive things. I must have them here somewhere. Beyond health insurance suggests we need a lot more than just kind of focusing even on medical services, let alone more expanded health insurance. We need stronger tools to improve health. Studies of avoidable deaths suggest that maybe about 10% of avoidable deaths are due to the availability or quality of health care. It's much more due to behavior, socioeconomic circumstances, environmental exposure, whether it's 40 to 50%. But the crowd runs toward kind of get me some dollars and kind of pay for this and cover it, as opposed to kind of what would actually change the demand equation, what's flowing into the system before we begin to treat it imperfectly or at least on a mediocre basis. There are limits to prevention, because if we just think of it as medicalized prevention, first you've got to target it, you've got to get compliance. But even there, we have a limit in terms of how many primary care physicians we have available to do all these recommended preventive services. We've got to get upstream and talk about primary prevention, all you do before you get in the doctor's office to change these kind of later developments, decades later of the chronic care costs, which you might have averted at an earlier age. And those premiums that are on your insurance are just going to reflect those claims costs coming in. You can't do, you know, miracles with insurance. Basically, if a lot of costs are coming into the system, you can squeeze them out a little bit with more efficient care. But the main thing is to keep them from occurring in the first place. So we need also, though, better downstream provider delivery of value. That's quick there. I'll go through that. So healthier people, more important than more coverage. Better performing providers and delivery. Education, a key factor in all this. We often negate that, but it's a bigger predictor of health than almost everything else. Early childhood, culture, behavior. Giving people some assistance in kind of working through the system. It's very complex, bizarre. We could spend a little bit less on kind of top-down regulation, a lot more on kind of helping people actually cope and know something about kind of what matters. is going to better working their way through the system. Obviously, a lot of deregulatory pulls there and some more incentives and accountability. Tax reform would help as well. We're going to rewrite the code in 2010. Maybe we'll do something on healthcare. Some better bundling of kind of what we currently do in a scattered way and then unbundle it again. Value purchasing, tiering is a possibility. Got to work longer, and that'll about do it there. The wild cards are, it's such a subjective definition of what healthcare is. You know, if you want last year's healthcare, it'd be a different cost than this year. So we kind of, it's an elastic concept. So we're actually putting more into the bundle than what we're comparing to in the past. Genetic information can go in several directions, might make us healthier in the long run, but in the short term, who knows? Medical tourism, let's outsource it. Maybe we can kind of get better deals. And I guess I'd like a little bit better look at kind of the way in which the economic cycles affect healthcare spending. There's, CMS does this. They basically talk about kind of there's a lag factor between kind of how the economy is doing and where health spending does. I think it's kind of even more sensitive to that in terms of some of these nearer term forecasts. But with that, I'm going to shut up. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Tom. Kid, do you want to take a couple minutes to respond to some of the points?
I'll just be brief. Let me mention three things briefly. The first is it might be worth clarifying our baseline. Our baseline is not supposed to keep everything fixed. It's supposed to keep federal policy fixed. And that's a much different thing than keeping the world fixed. And the challenge that we face in these projections is, and actually in every projection, is that there's a certain awkwardness in projecting forward an unsustainable federal policy. And that awkwardness is going to show up in some way. In the overall fiscal projections that we'll be coming out with in December, I'm not going to be saying anything that will shock anyone. Some of the outcomes will involve very high debt to GDP ratios that frankly could never actually happen. It's implausible to me that we would hit 4 or 5 or 600% of GDP in federal debt because the federal government would no longer be able to sell debt then. But we're supposed to show the implications of an unchanged federal policy. We're not supposed to keep private behavior and state government behavior fixed. And so I just wanted to clarify that. The only other two things I'd say is I completely agree that health behavior has a much stronger effect on health outcomes than the healthcare system does. And we are paying far too little attention to diet, exercise, lifestyle, and what have you in the United States relative to focusing on, quote, healthcare, end quote. It's fascinating to me that in other areas we've had significant advances in figuring out how to help people do what they seem to want to do, but then have trouble implementing. So in retirement saving, most people say they want to save for retirement, but they just have difficulty, it's complicated, they don't get around to it. Automatically enrolling people in a 401k and letting them opt out substantially boosts participation relative to having them sign up for it in the first place, even though from a sort of purely rational economics 101 perspective, it shouldn't matter. We don't have yet the equivalence of opt-out 401ks in the health arena, and I think a lot more attention needs to be paid to how people actually behave. There are hints of the fact that what we eat, for example, is very strongly influenced just by framing and how things are presented and where things are placed even in a cafeteria line. So putting fruit and vegetables at the front of a cafeteria line instead of at the back significantly boosts consumption of fruit and vegetables. Someone told me the other day, and I haven't seen the study myself, but that apparently one of the best ways of getting middle-aged men to eat fruit and vegetables is to put it on the same shelf as beer. In any case, we are not fully exploring all of the various ways that people actually make decisions and then helping them to make the decisions that they seem to want to make but have difficulty doing in the real world. Final point is Tom mentioned education and its effects on health and on life expectancy, and I would just underscore that. One of the phenomena that has gotten too little attention both here in the United States and abroad is the fact that we all know that life expectancy is going up. Many of us know that better educated, higher income people live longer than less educated, lower income people. Few people seem to know that the gap is expanding very substantially. Over the past 2 to 3 decades, life expectancy has gone up on average, but it's gone up much faster for better educated, high income people. And I think there are various reasons to expect that that trend may continue, and I don't think that we have addressed the potential social consequences. It could have significant effects even on our federal programs. For example, that effect by itself makes programs like Social Security or Medicare less progressive on a lifetime basis, because higher income people, to the extent that they are increasingly living a longer number of years, are collecting benefits for an increasingly longer period of time relative to lower income people. And that's just one consequence. I think there are a whole variety of consequences that we have not fully explored. And this differential trend is occurring not just in the United States, but in continental Europe and the UK also. So it's something that I think has gotten some attention among demographers, but has not received the broader attention that it would seem to deserve.
Thanks, Peter. So we're going to have some time for Q&A right now. Scott has the microphone, where it's really crucial that you ask a question into the microphone. Also important that you identify yourself and make sure it's a question. So just well, some statement. Sometimes you can form a question out of a statement. Before we get there, because we have plenty of time for that, I want to ask Peter one question about a recent debate going on in the media, potentially taking his name in vain on this issue. Between Ruth Marcus of the Washington Post and Paul Krugman of the New York Times. My understanding of how the evolution is that Paul basically was criticizing Obama for with too much focus on Social Security, not enough focus on health care. And maybe that's consistent with what you're saying today. Health care is potentially the much bigger issue. Ruth Marcus replied and said that, even Peter Orszag's doing all this work in Social Security. Social Security is, in fact, the big problem. How do you respond to this?
I'm sort of puzzled a little bit by this debate, I have to admit, because to say that problem A is bigger than problem B is not to say that problem B doesn't exist. So to say, if you suffer a heart attack and you fracture your hip at the same time, you want to fix both problems and not ignore one or the other. Healthcare, I believe, is the central long-term fiscal challenge facing the United States, but aging and demographics and Social Security is also an issue. And frankly, it's easier in some sense to address because we kind of know what to do. I've written books, I'm sure there are many people in the room who have written books that list the table of options for Social Security, and it's fairly known. I mean, Kent has worked on Social Security, lots of people have. And for Social Security, the benefit or the reason that it would make sense to sort of try to address that first is that precisely that we do know what the steps are that would reach balance in the program. So for Social Security, the typical thought that we just need to lock policymakers in a room and not let them out, don't give them any food and not let them out until they come out with a solution, that would, well, assuming you could actually do it, that would kind of work because we know what the menu of options are. For the larger and more important problem of healthcare, however, I haven't seen a single credible plan that would restore long-term financial balance to Medicare and Medicaid, period. So the thought that all we need to do is kind of lock policymakers in a room or all that's lacking is political will is a little bit puzzling because I don't know exactly what they would talk about in the absence of more information and more analysis and more options about what would work. So I view the two issues as not mutually exclusive. Social Security is readily addressable with already known policy options. Healthcare is by far the more important long-term fiscal challenge facing the United States. We need to be presumably doing many things. But the specific options that would restore long-term balance to Medicare and Medicaid currently are not completely known.
Good, thanks. Okay, so questions, and why don't we start up here and we'll work our way back again. If you just give us your name and your question.
Jean Montgomery. I'm assuming it would be useful to break these numbers down by disease process, at least in general categories to begin with. My question would be, do we know now the components of that cost increase by disease category, and do we have some idea whether there's more excess cost in one disease category than another? Do we know more about the effectiveness of preventive methods in one category or another?
Let me tackle that first. Several comments. First, coming back to the concentration of costs, it is the case that those high-cost beneficiaries disproportionately have one or more chronic conditions, the top five or six chronic conditions. Many people have tried to do different cost allocations historically. For example, to allocate a certain cost to the rising obesity trend in the United States, which we actually haven't talked very much about, which is associated with type 2 diabetes and other disease channels. Actually, CBO has done its own analysis of that, and relative to some other published estimates, we get a smaller share of the cost increase coming from increased levels of obesity in the United States. We can talk more about that. But so the answer is yes, people have tried to do some of that kind of analysis. Similarly, for Medicare, there has been work done on attributing cost growth to various chronic conditions. In terms of our projections, we did not adopt that methodology, in part because it seems easier to project an aggregate than to do the subclassifications that would add up to that aggregate. It's very difficult to be accurately predicting obesity trends over the next 75 years, for example. I'm not saying that anything we do is easy, but there was extensive discussion about whether we should do a sort of bottom-up approach or a top-down approach, and the thought was that for this purpose, at least, the top-down approach would be beneficial. You also asked about prevention and disease management for some of these cases. I would say I have been struck that many of the things that we believe work to reduce costs as opposed to improve quality, unfortunately, the evidence backing that those cost reductions is often weaker than I would like, and is typically weaker than would allow me to include in a CBO score. So take disease management, for example. Tom had already mentioned, one of the problems with disease management is you're applying it to a lot of people, and so you may be applying it to people where it doesn't have a big effect, so you have extra costs there for no added benefit. For the people that you are sort of properly targeting, there's also a question of how effective it actually is. Outside of congestive heart failure, where I think there is some evidence that disease management programs could reduce costs, in aggregate, so just generically, there is not as much support for the thought that disease management will reduce costs as I'd like. And I'd say similarly, you know, prevention often is a little bit nebulous a concept, but in general, at least thus far, the evidence suggesting that prevention has any effect on costs over a 5 or 10 year period is not particularly strong.
There's been some work for a number of years, aside from the Ken Thorpe Enterprises Incorporated, that says everything is prevalence and disease costs. They use MEPS data, they'll be like the top 20 most expensive conditions. They vary a little bit, whether it's a Medicare population, whether it's a Medicaid population, whether it's a below 65 privately insured. And that kind of gives you a certain labeling process, and it's not always the same. One thing to watch out for, though, is part of it, not entirely, is we're just getting better at kind of putting names on things and detecting them. We don't know as much, and that can be that backward tracing to say, well, how much of these chronic illnesses, were they there in the past? We just kind of now find them and kind of can attach a billing code, and then they're treated more intensively now. There's also some evidence that although, at least among the elderly, there's a greater incidence of chronic diseases, they're less severe. Now, partly could it be better treatment in earlier time. I mean, give some credit to the healthcare system in that regard. But it's not as clear cut that just because we can say there are more chronic illnesses that they're necessarily showing up in terms of kind of the major contributor to that cost growth. You're just kind of finding what sick people tend to be expensive. They always have been.
last time I checked, but we've got new names for it. We call it a chronic illness. Now, the obesity factor is a little bit more off the charts. We're not sure about that. But even on diabetes, I think there's been some recent evidence suggesting that the actual, you know, projections and the cost of these series aren't as great. We just found out ways to kind of call it diabetes in an earlier stage and kind of, you know, throw some resources at it. So I'll stop at that point.
I think there's some more hands. While we got the...
Thank you. Yeah. My name is Greg Shuckman. I'm from the University of Central Florida. The question I have is because you have a lot of these costs on the out years that are growth, wouldn't it make sense in terms of investing in research and early diagnostics and those kinds of things, pharmacogenomics, as you had mentioned, in terms of our ability to predict on an individual basis, but if we're investing more in medical research and investing more in diagnostic tools, wouldn't that help reduce the cost in the out years?
It might, but it might not. We might just spend more on care that doesn't kind of get to the root cause and stuff. The question is the opportunity cost. Certainly, if you throw enough money at something, you'll get some good results out of it. We had a space program. We got Tang out of it, right? But in terms of kind of what that money might have been invested for something else, maybe it would have had some other things. I'm suggesting kind of there are a lot of other things in terms of kind of providing better underpinnings for those who are less fortunate, whether it's education, whether it's better economic development. It might turn out that they'll be healthier 50 years from now than trying to do a patch job on what's blown out in the tire after a lifetime of other things created. Of course, we need a balance in that regard. But most of our system has been about guaranteeing the money will be there for that technology growth, medical innovation, and it's not always cost-reducing. It could be. Peter was talking about the effects of education. And this is not solid research because it hasn't been followed up. But I think Dana Goldman and Grant did this work about 4 or 5 years ago with a colleague, suggesting that as the population becomes better educated, it consumes technology which is cost-increasing rather than cost-reducing. You don't get the no-brainer vaccines or the antibiotics which kind of occur population-wide and kind of bring down everybody's costs. What you have to do is you have to be smart enough to use the system. You've got to invest some of your own time. You have to be skilled in working through the system. Better educated people do that. And our system somewhat responds to that. So the drugs we get, although they may be terrific, they kind of tend to be also more costly in the final analysis. And people like it because they get a better quality of life and they can afford it. But it may leave some other people behind who can't rise above that initial floor to kind of play in the game because the overall healthcare system has gotten incredibly expensive.
Let me just say a couple things. The first is that in healthcare, a lot of innovation is allowing us to treat and do things that were impossible before. So that improves outcomes on average, but it's cost increasing. It's not cost reducing. Something that basically was impossible before or had an infinite cost associated with it becomes possible, and in terms of observed cost, that drives up spending. More importantly than that observation, though, I think, is, again, coming back to the financial incentives that we have. We have financial incentives for more innovation, period. Not higher value innovation, not better innovation, just more. As long as it passes some very, very low threshold, we do it. Given the opportunity costs that Tom mentioned and the fact that we are going to and we have been spending more and more on healthcare, I think we need to get a lot smarter about steering incentives so that the innovation is occurring in the highest value areas and leading to the largest improvement possible. Because another way of putting it is, if we're going to wind up spending 20% of GDP on Medicare and Medicaid, shouldn't we make sure we're getting as much from it as possible? The current set of financial incentives will not deliver that.
If it's really quick, yeah.
You mentioned earlier about the need to have primary care physicians being able to deliver all of the services.
They can't.
Well, do we have a shortage?
Even if we have a shortage, we have a shortage, and people would rather have better lifestyles and get paid more. They're irrational in that regard, and they're going to dermatology. Some of that can change, but the fact is, there was an article about 4 or 5 years ago by some Duke researchers, which said that if you actually had a primary care physician deliver all the recommended care that's there in the guidebook, They would spend their entire working year just doing that. They wouldn't have time for anything else. Sorry, I can't talk to you about your other symptoms or illnesses. It overwhelms the physician delivery system to think that all we can think of in terms of preventive possibly might be good for you, in the theory. So we can't medicalize it entirely. Now, there may be ways to kind of take that preventive activity and move it upstream to people where, through enhanced information, other types of resources to reach out for them beyond nagging nurses, we begin to kind of have other, you know, softer agents who don't cost as much, or those who can kind of assist you and coach you to get you kind of involved in doing more preventive activities. But to medicalize it through primary care doctors is not the way to go. It doesn't match the available resources.
Let me just say one thing quickly, not specifically on primary care physicians, but on physicians more broadly speaking, including specialists. And that has to do with the current payment structure under Medicare, which is governed by the so-called sustainable growth rate formula, which is basically a hard cap, if you will, on total payments. What has happened over the years, and I think it's probably a safe bet to believe it will happen again either later this year or early next year, is that cap is overridden by Congress. And I think what that underscores is it is often said that what we need, or some people say what we need in healthcare, is some sort of cap. We'll just cap spending. If you don't get at the underlying drivers of spending, that cap isn't going to do very much. It's just going to get waived over and over and over again. And I believe that's what occurred in, or what is occurring with regard to physician payments. We haven't addressed the underlying issue. We just tried to kind of impose a cap on total spending, and that cap, it has not been, and at least in the near term, is unlikely to be enforced, suggesting to me that those who believe that all we need to do is put some hard cap on Medicare and Medicaid spending without getting to these underlying issues are likely to wind up in the same kind of situation where the cap just gets waived.
I just want to say one more thing about kind of, you know, technology growth, the wonders of research and innovation. I said before that kind of, you know, when you look at kind of the situation, either we've already got the solution and it's wonderful, or the problem that solves itself. If you look at the work of some researchers, you know, Frank Lichtenberg, you know, put a dollar in, you get $7 out of benefits in terms of pharmacy. You can do Murphy and Topel. You know, the wonders of kind of research are just so tremendous. You can do the Cutler and McClellan work. Well, you know, with that heart disease, that may pay for itself and kind of the other small interventions. So why don't we spend, you know, 50% of GDP if this stuff is so good? It just keeps giving and giving and giving. So there's no pain whatsoever if you are in that scope of the world. Now, that's kind of looking at average benefits as opposed to marginal benefits. On the other hand, if you follow the line of analysis that Peter's suggesting, you know, the 30% rule, well, 30% of the geographic variation, that's pretty much garbage. You look at the efficiency folks, there's another 30% of waste in there, and you do the cost sharing, and 30% you need to kind of spend anyway. So it's not that painful to cut back, because we're just getting rid of stuff that isn't worth anything. There might be some good things along the way. So we have these kind of like two parallel worlds, aren't talking to each other at all, and part of it is the difference between aggregate and average, but it's neither an all-giving, all-wonderful, just put more dollars in. It's not all bad either, but we do have a good bit that could use more than just a modest, you know, blade nick with a scalpel. We could get much more out of the healthcare system, and we're spending a lot already.
All right. Yes. Right there.
Paul McLaughlin with the New America Foundation. Dr. Rosenblatt, you showed a chart that attributed a very small portion of the Medicare medical cost growth to the effect of the aging population, and a very large portion to the effect of excess cost growth.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to raise the issue of aging again as it relates to economic growth and to revenue over time. Does that bring sort of Social Security back into the picture when we're talking about fiscal and not merely Medicare cost growth, but revenues and expenditures? Does aging and the decreased economic growth and the decreased tax revenue that are associated with that, do those make Social Security and just aging issues in general a little bit more important in this discussion?
Yeah, when you add Social Security in, for example, you do have a somewhat more pronounced effect of pure demographics on the nation's fiscal balance. In the report that will be coming out in December, we will provide a more comprehensive view of the effects of demographics and aging on the fiscal balance. I think it's easy to kind of just do the simple math, though. which is that over that projection window, for example, Medicare and Medicaid costs go up by about 15% of GDP, of which under 2% of GDP is due to aging. Over the same period, Social Security goes up by 2-2.5% of GDP or so. So you can still see that the vast bulk of the projected increases are not coming from pure demographics. And again, I would just emphasize that demographics are an issue. The coming retirement of the baby boom generation and ongoing increases in life expectancy and the associated reduction in fertility rates that has occurred over the past several decades, all of that has an effect on the federal budget, but it's not nearly as big as the effect of whether that excess cost growth rate turns out to be 2% or 1.5 or 1% or 0.5. That's a much bigger deal, in part, by the way, because it also has an effect on tax revenue. The faster healthcare costs grow, given the tax preferences for private health insurance through employer-sponsored insurance in particular, the smaller the tax base is for any given aggregate level of compensation to workers. So our fiscal projections will also incorporate that effect from the underlying rate of healthcare cost growth, and it makes the federal budget even more sensitive to that fundamental factor.
Taxation. Peter, a few moments ago, you put your finger on what I think is pretty important, and Tom's mentioned it as well, and that is cost is really here being referred to as expenditures rather than cost per unit or something that would drive individual choice. If new technologies become available, if you can have a heart transplant or new stem cell work gives you tissue replacement or something like that, and we add it to the Ryan basket, and we make it an assumption at the government level that everybody shall have the total basket, whether it's really their preference or not, then it's the government that's sort of driving this expansion of what you're calling cost, and it puts it on its own budget. If I were faced with the choice of either having a new car every 3 years and a vacation every year and possibly not having the money for a heart transplant when I'm 90, or the other way around, I would make that choice. The government's making it for me, and I'm going to get that heart transplant either by paying taxes myself or by having my neighbor pay taxes. Could we clarify this notion of cost? And I don't see how you can ration these things other than by fiat if this decision is taken out of the hands of the patients and the consumers over their lifetime.
Let me say a couple things. Before I get to the question of federal policy, I would just note the information that I believe is currently lacking. Estimates suggest that under half of the healthcare that's delivered in the United States is backed by solid medical evidence suggesting that it's more effective than alternatives. Is a problem not just for Medicare and Medicaid, it's a problem for you as a consumer. You don't know whether that heart transplant is more effective than this other thing or this other thing, and in the absence of that kind of information, how are you supposed to make an informed choice? So the information that we are currently lacking, this comparative or clinical effectiveness and including cost effectiveness, is important not just for federal policy, but frankly it's important for the vision of consumer-directed health care also, because you need it to make informed choices. Now I agree on the fundamental point that the federal budget is focused on costs and spending. It is not focused on the quality or outcomes that we obtain for that spending. And that occurs not just in healthcare, but it occurs in, defense spending and education and lots of other areas also. In healthcare, I think what's clear is that if you look over the past several decades, healthcare spending has gone up and health outcomes have improved. It's actually striking that despite the increase in obesity that is problematic, the reduction in smoking, the better control of hypertension, increased pharmaceutical use and other things have actually led to, when you sort of throw it all together, an improvement in health outcomes. And therefore, that leads some people to say the higher spending has caused the improved health outcomes. And that's where things get a little tricky, because I think coming back to this basic point, on average, an innovation, take an MRI, on average, the MRI has improved health outcomes. But it then gets applied in all sorts of settings where it's low or it's hard to tell a story where it's negative value, but low or zero value, driving up costs without improving outcomes. So I agree that we're not at a sort of very detailed level tying costs to outcomes. That is a direction that we need to be moving in, but we can't move there without much better information on, and frankly, a much more universal system of electronic health records that will allow the measurement to occur that ties this kind of spending to that kind of outcome. And one other point I would note about that. The economics field, having struggled with the imperfections of panel data econometrics for decades and decades, is increasingly yearning for various clever randomized experiments, some of which I had the privilege of working on before I took over at CBO. I would note that I think the medical profession, out of necessity, is going to have to move partly in the other direction. And that is to say, it is implausible to me that given the whole variety of clinical interventions and delivery system questions that we need more information about what the degree to which it improves outcomes, that you're going to do randomized control trials on all those things. Should you go back and see the doctor four times a month or only twice a month after your hip fracture surgery, you're not going to be doing randomized control trials on all sorts of things like that. That will require analyzing basically huge data sets of patients, some of whom went to the doctor four times a month after surgery and some of whom went two times a month, and trying to control as best you can for the other things that vary across the patients to tease out the effect of the additional visits. I'm not sure that the medical profession is yet in a place that will accept the lower standard of quality in terms of evidence that will be necessary in order to build out the information base, because it will require using non-randomized evidence.
Let me hijack Peter's comments to follow up on something on Rand and cost sharing, and then I'll get back to Steve's question. The point about kind of, well, whether it's a little over 50%, a little less than 50% of healthcare today, you know, we don't know whether we get kind of the right stuff and whether it makes a difference. That's the reason why, under the RAND cost sharing, you found no, you know, negative health effects. What the conclusion was is that the margin, the negative effects of unnecessary or inappropriate care tended to balance out the beneficial effects of appropriate care. So you could flip a coin or you could go see the doctor. But that's kind of, you know, then we may be a little bit better in that regard, but it suggested kind of more tends to kind of have a bit of a wash once you get kind of to a basic threshold. On the point of, you know, where's the value in this and kind of who should choose? There's another recent study, Hall and Jones, which tried to say, you know, this spending is so great we can do even more of it. And one of the arguments in that regard was, well, when you're really getting up there in age, you know, the value of your statistical life to you for healthcare is pretty high. What else are you going to spend your money on? It kind of flips it over entirely, which says you don't want to consume anything else, so you might as well kind of throw it out. And the problem there, of course, is people are not spending their own money. It's the time inconsistency. Of course, when we're all with a critical illness and we're 80 years old, we want everything thrown at us. But we wouldn't have made that choice if we had to make it when we were 20. So the point is, since we don't look at kind of the internalized costs over the entire life cycle, if you back-end it politically, there's always going to be demand spending someone else's money to do all these things, and it's a great payoff for you. But it reverses the normal decision-making process where you balance it off in terms of a lifetime value equation.
Okay, in the back?
Hi, BJ Vitus, The Economist. You've talked a lot about comparative effectiveness and the need for more data, some of the challenges.
If you had
any specific suggestions on
how
the U.S. might head in that direction? In some of the European countries, the U.K. has a nice agency, there are examples. I wonder if you either draw inspiration or fear and might offer some ridicule of some of those other approaches as to what might be a lesson for the U.S.
Well, we are going to be coming out within the next few weeks with a long report on different options for comparative effectiveness, for organizing a comparative effectiveness entity or entities. And that report draws upon the National Institute for Clinical Excellence in the UK and other experiences in other countries. They did come up with a nice acronym. National Institute for Clinical Excellence is nice. And I would just say there are various trade-offs. I mean, there's a question about whether this activity is best located within a government agency. Some people believe not. Whether it could be located in a quasi-governmental entity like an Institute of Medicine type thing, how it should be funded, where it should devote its resources first, what kind of evidence is brought to bear, whether it's just doing kind of literature surveys or whether it's doing original research, whether it's doing randomized control trials, how that's all being done, all of which is discussed in our forthcoming report. What I would emphasize, though, is you can do all the research in the world, and if it's not adopted in medical practice, it won't matter. So simply publicizing or publishing the information in a way that will be easily accessible for physicians, I think, will have some effect. And we've seen evidence of examples where simply providing clarity and information does drive some behavior. But that's a pretty minor effect. The big payoff will come from tying financial incentives to the results of what works and what doesn't, of sort of of the results of this kind of comparative effectiveness research. Unless you're altering financial incentives, which is going to be very difficult to accomplish, you're not likely to get that big a kick from the additional research, because I don't think you'll have as big an effect on the way medicine is practiced.
All right, I think you wait one more question here.
Hi, I'm Peter McMenamin, a health panelist from Silver Spring. It's hard to argue against the value of cost-effectiveness research, but I think it's much more uncertain than certainly the medical establishment seems to think, if only because health outcomes are not scalars, they're vectors. The FDA cleverly sort of makes them into scalars by eliminating certain side effects and others. But if you really get into not only the different effects on the same people, but in some cases different effects on subpopulations, as we've seen with Bidil, in a general population that would not be cost effective, but in African Americans it is more cost effective. I think we've seen, many of us saw a presentation earlier that from a British nurse who said, nice can be nasty, as in not available, so treat yourself. Are we close enough to certainty that you can really envision doing head-to-head drug trials or specifically saying, we're not going to cover this technology because, well, it might be good for some people, on average, it's not as good as some other drug?
Let me answer that in the following way. I think in the United States, it's less likely from a political economy perspective that we're going to have on-off switches, that we're going to say this simply will not be available. And what seems more feasible from a political economy perspective is the kind of tiered incentives that we've already experienced, many of us have in our drug plans, where you have a financial incentive for generics and for certain preferred brand drugs, and you pay more if you want something else. Similarly, one can imagine, I think this is very difficult to design and implement, but it seems to me more feasible, from a political economy perspective, than just some entity says yes or no, and then the Medicare system takes that and says yes or no, to have a kind of more flexible set of financial incentives where take a hypothetical example where this treatment is shown on average to be more effective than that treatment. Even if we were, you know, benevolent dictator, even if I were in charge of the healthcare system, I would still want the individual physician to have some flexibility to say, no, wait a minute, that's actually great on average, but I know more about you. And so for you, this other treatment is more auspicious. I'd like to try it with you. So one can take that and think about that. One can imagine systems where if for 10% of the doctor's patients, the thing that was shown on average to be less effective is being administered, that may be more about the patients. If for 90% of the doctor's patients, that's what's being recommended or administered, that's probably more about the doctor. So you can imagine systems where there's either carve-outs or safe harbors or just differential financial incentives that allow both kind of treatment, and coming to your point about subpopulations, that will be very important, but that try to steer the medical system as a whole towards what has been shown on average to be more effective.
Let me just take one final shot, because we did do a conference on physician performance measurement just earlier this month. Look, we're always spun in multiple directions. Doctors will say, just tell me what the rules are. Don't measure everything. Don't measure it inconsistently. And I kind of all perform well. And of course, all my patients are sicker than everyone else, and I do wonderfully. We first have a front-end problem of kind of just having enough data to mean anything. So that's an aggregation issue. And there are currently approaches to getting this underway. You can do it kind of all. Medicare will tell you what it means. We can try to have a little bit more of a collaboration, but we're moving in that direction. But even there, what we want are competing stances on what is value. It might be different insurers think about it differently. And obviously, you've got to have a certain, you know, commonality of measures and commonality of data. But not everybody should think the same thing in terms of what pays off. Now, that starts at the insurer level. The problem there is the insurers might be able to pull the data together, but people don't trust them. They don't trust their employer. They don't trust their government. They don't trust themselves, probably. Maybe they trust their doctor, and that may be the least wise course in some cases. But if you at least allow enough measures out there, and you allow the consumer to weight them by their preferences, different things are important to different people. Then you've at least got a chance to kind of have the system responding to the person who's receiving this care. Not everybody's going to do it, but a few people will do it. It'll marginally change market share. You can also at least squeeze down the outliers. You're not going to say because you're 5% different than someone else, it makes a big difference. But there's some people who are very good, I'm going to leave them alone, maybe reward them a little bit. Some people are very bad, and they ought to get with the program. They shouldn't just kind of get more business. So that's kind of in essence what we have to do. But this all reflects kind of the fundamental tension between having a defined benefit as opposed to a defined contribution. You got a defined benefit, someone's going to say what's in it and what's covered. Whereas if you first got the money and then you bought the benefit you wanted a little bit more skilled and customized, and there might only be some variations in that regard, you'd have a chance to begin to kind of have those preferences and those different opinions on value begin to make a difference.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I promised Peter that I would finish on time to get him back in. He has a busy schedule, and thanks, Tom, as well, for all your comments. Thanks for coming.